The year was 1983. We'd just taken the training wheels off of my two-wheeler and I was giving it a whirl. My dad was behind me, holding onto the bike to help me balance. Or so I thought. I was actually riding on my own for a while without knowing it. Panic set in for a split second, but then total freedom. For people my age, that's a pretty commonplace memory. But in recent decades, kids have not been learning to ride bikes at the rates they used to. I'm Gina Kaufman, this is Central Standard, and we'll explore that trend in a moment. For now, let's go with Alex Smith to check out some local programs working to get kids back in gear.
And here are the kids.
On a warm afternoon at Garfield Elementary School in northeast Kansas City, a class of grade schoolers charge out into the schoolyard to spend an hour riding bikes. They're getting training from members of the nonprofit group Bike Walk KC. The program was created 3 years ago to teach bike safety skills, but organizer Maggie Priestmeyer says that she and fellow instructors found they would often be teaching children to ride for the first time.
I don't know where, you know, what their family situation is when they're 10 years old and they've never learned how to ride a bike.
The growing number of kids who don't or can't ride a bike isn't unique to this neighborhood or any part of Kansas City. A new report by the National Sporting Goods Association estimates that just over 10 million kids in the U.S. between the ages of 6 and 18 biked regularly last year. Based on nationwide surveys, that's fewer than half of the number from just 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's definitely a decline.
Marty Machachik of the National Sporting Goods Association says that adult cycling has remained pretty steady over the past decade or so, but the downward trend among kids has been dramatic, and it's just one aspect of a larger trend.
There's been a general decline and a concern, not only of our industry, but of pretty much throughout the country, of the inactivity levels, not just for children, but all ages.
In a 2012 article in the medical journal Lancet, one researcher declared physical inactivity a global pandemic, and it's thought to play a big part in the 17% obesity rate among American children. Experts say physical inactivity heightens the risk of dying prematurely, dying of heart disease, and developing diabetes, colon cancer, and high blood pressure. Not only that, but inactive kids miss out on the benefits of regular exercise, which include better mental focus and motivation. Video games, along with TV, smartphones, and other high-tech distractions, may be factors in the decline of cycling among kids. Lots of studies show that the time kids once spent on sports, biking, and other physically active pursuits is now spent in front of a screen. But biking faces other challenges as well, according to Sarah Zimmerman of the National Center for Safe Routes to School.
There have been big changes in how our communities are designed.
Zimmerman is the Technical Assistance Director for the Safe Routes to School National Partnership, which encourages biking and walking to school. She says that in the late 60s, half of kids either biked or walked to nearby schools. But the breakdown of neighborhood schools, along with the advent of magnet schools and suburban sprawl, has changed that.
The biggest reason identified by parents for their kids not walking or biking to school is the fact that they live too far from the school.
Surveys by Safe Routes show that just about 13% of kids now either ride or walk to school. At the same time, the rates of kids taking the bus has remained about the same. That means more and more school children are getting car rides. Safe Routes hopes that by encouraging school districts to return their focus to neighborhood schools, they can reverse that trend. But that's not the only reason for the drop-off in biking.
There was just a huge surge in parental concern about abductions that happened.
And scare headlines have generated a rash of misplaced fears among parents, says Nancy McBride of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
The cases that we generally hear about are the cases that are the most tragic and awful for the child. So that scares everybody.
In fact, statistics show that just over 100 kids in the U.S. are kidnapped in public by strangers every year, a number that has remained pretty steady. Far more often, children are taken by relatives or family friends.
It doesn't mean that keeping our kids in the house is going to be the solution to the issue. What it means is that we, the adults, step up and do a really good job of supervising and monitoring our kids.
Now try to keep the bike straight. Keep pushing.
At Garfield Elementary, biking instructor Mary Estrada coaches a pair of sisters who grimace and giggle nervously. A few weeks ago, they didn't know how to ride, but now they're starting to get the hang of it.
Keep pedaling, keep pedaling. Wow, you did it, see?
Although Bike Walk KC organizers focus on the health aspects of cycling, Maggie Priestmeyer admits that a big part of its appeal is the sheer fun of it all. Although the program wasn't created to teach first-timers, she says it's become one of the most rewarding parts of her job.
When they ride, it's like the best thing that's ever happened to them, and you can see it in their face.
And if it can continue to replicate that excitement, maybe Bike Walk KC can begin to reverse those negative biking trends among kids.
Good job.
That was Alex Smith reporting for the Heartland Health Monitor. At Central Standard, we've been intrigued by this finding that kids aren't even learning to ride bikes, let alone actually riding them like we did when we were kids. So this morning, we're delving into a couple of the explanations Alex mentioned in his story. Parents being afraid of the independence and mobility bikes provide, with fears of things like abductions, and also changes in how communities are designed. With us now is Lenore Skenazy, the author of Free Range Kids. She runs the blog by the same name. Hi, Lenore.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning to you. Free range parenting has become a movement that's gained real traction since you published your book. Give me the quick and dirty definition of the term free range as it applies to parenting and childhood.
Okay, free range actually isn't a parenting or a child rearing technique. It's simply the belief that our kids are not in constant danger. Once you think the kids are in constant danger, of course, you start keeping them inside and they can't do anything. So it's really just changing the perception that's been shoved down our throats that anytime we let the kids go outside, they are going to be murdered. Not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah, this is all in reaction to something. What is that something?
It's what I call worst first thinking. It's coming up with the worst case scenario first and proceeding as if it's likely to happen. So if I say, gee, I wonder if my kid can wait at the bus stop by herself. And somebody else says, what about J.C. Dugard? She was at the bus stop and she was kidnapped for 18 years. And saying, oh, that's right. And then proceeding not to let your kid go to the bus stop because of one horrible instance somewhere. And, you know, things weren't perfect. There was crime even when I was growing up. But somehow our generation of parents, the parents who brought us up, today's parents up, were able to keep that in perspective. And they didn't feel like they had to go through a catechism of Eitan Peitz, Elizabeth Smart, J.C. Dugard before they let their kids do anything outside. Now it's almost as if parents feel guilty if they're not thinking up that worst case scenario. And that is turning our kids into what we were just talking about, that 17% obesity rate, the idea that kids can't ride bicycles. What I heard, I was talking to one childhood historian the other day who said that today's kids, a lot of them have no concept of far. Because everything is a car ride away. So whether you're talking about Florida or the pharmacist, they're both far.
You know, you mentioned that somehow this has happened to parents, that they've become afraid. Mm-hmm. But you've been researching this for years now.
Oh, my God. I sure have.
You must have a theory about what somehow is.
Right. The somehow is that our brains work like Google. And when my mom was raising me, we hadn't become this intensely mediafied country. And, you know, the story that gets people to watch TV and stay glued to television, the one that has proven the best for ratings, as sickening as that is the story of a white middle-class child kidnapped or murdered, which is why when I give lectures, I sometimes ask the audience if they've heard the name Maddie McCann. And a lot of people nod. She was a girl taken from her hotel room in Portugal in about 10 years ago at this point. And her parents were doctors. She was white. She was upper middle class. And I say, okay, you know, people raise their hands. And I say, okay, now I'm going to give you a little pop quiz. Can you tell me anything else that has happened in Portugal in the last 500 years? And of course, people laugh because no, there is only one story that mattered enough to send our camera crews from CNN and Fox and ABC, whatever, overseas to that country, and that was a middle-class white kid who disappeared.
You mentioned,
and when you have that story just constantly shoved down your throats, that's what comes up whenever you think, is my kid safe? And then up come these pictures.
Is the idea here that we are talking about the parents of white middle-class kids then primarily?
No, I think we're talking about all parents. I'm just saying that the story that generally makes it to the news happens to be white and middle-class because that's who the the news anchors, or not the news anchors, the producers are asking for. And then you see these stories reiterated in Law and Order and NCIS. I mean, and you go to the movies and there's Taken with Liam Neeson and he's looking for his kid. And then you read a book and it's by the Kellermans and there's a child who's been raped and murdered. I mean, it's just, it's the go-to easy narrative of the day that we know will get people to buy the book, read the newspaper, watch TV. And while there was TV and media when my parents were raising me, first of all, it wasn't quite as intense. And secondly, you weren't considered a bad parent for saying, that's true, some bad things happen, but life goes on. Nowadays, you really have to say, oh my God, what if? That's why we arrest parents who let their kids wait in the car for 2 minutes while they run in and pick up the pizza. Not because their children are truly in danger in 2 minutes, but because we've allowed what if thinking, this worst first thinking, to so invade our consciousness that we think, well, what if somebody came and stole the child from the car when she was waiting there for 2 minutes while the mom paid for the pizza and she wasn't looking for a second? And so it has really become a knee-jerk reaction in our country to automatically picture our children not only in danger, but in terrible, awful, horrific danger that we would never be forgiven for, because a good parent, like the lady from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was saying, should be constantly vigilant. And I'm saying, you know what? You don't have to be constantly vigilant. Our crime rate today is back to what it was when we were growing up. It's back to the rate of 1963, so it's actually probably lower today.
I want to jump in. I want to jump in because this originated with a story in 2008. You were actually called America's worst mom. Can you tell that story?
Oh, sure. Back in 2008, when my younger son was 9, he started asking me and my husband if we would take him someplace he had never been before in New York City, where we live, and let him find his own way home on the subway. And I did, and I wrote a column about it, and that's how I got on every television show defending myself, and the nickname I got was America's Worst Mom, because today, the thing that I did wrong was not put him on the subway. In every conversation on the news shows and on the interview shows since then, and of course back then, the interviewer would always say to me this question, but Lenore, how would you have felt if he never came home? And you know, they know how I would feel if my son never came home. So clearly it wasn't really a question. It was an accusation. And the accusation is this one, this thing I'm trying desperately to get us to understand, and for me even to understand. The thing I had done wrong was I hadn't imagined him never coming home, and how would I have felt, and all the regret, and all the remorse, and all the sorrow, and all the aloneness I would feel. That's literally what I did wrong. I didn't go to that very dark place. And now parents feel compelled to go to that place, in part because we're told that you should. And I was yelled at for not going to that place. So it's hard to send your kid out on a bike, even if you have the most happy memories of getting on your bike and riding out there on a summer's day till the streetlights came on and you could see the fireflies and it was the greatest time of your life. And you wish you could give that to your kid, but you can't, because how would you feel if? And I'm trying to take the blame and the guilt and the almost proactive guilt away from parents, saying, very, you know, we're living in safe times. It's never going to be perfect. If something bad happens, it's not the result of bad parenting. But this blame, this fear of blame and fear of danger together are this very toxic, very paralyzing combination that I'm trying to help us break through.
This trend when it comes to kids and biking, is that something that you've heard before, or is this news to you?
I had only heard it recently. A reporter from another place just called up last week and said, you know, what about all these 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds who are trying to learn how to ride bikes? And I was like, oh, I hadn't heard about that. But on this TV show I did, which was called World's Worst Mom, I went around to 13 very, very overprotective families and helped them break through, which I'll tell you about. It's really easy. And that's the amazing thing. It's all this fear can be broken through pretty much instantaneously. And with this first family I did, the mother still cut the boy's meat for him and food for him and sometimes fed him in his mouth. And he's 10. And so she'd never let him use a knife. And another thing she'd never let him do was ride a bike. And her fear was twofold. One was that he would hurt himself, mangle himself, of course, and be hurt that way. But she was also worried that he would be hurt emotionally, because it's difficult to learn how to ride a bike. And what if he was frustrated? And she thought that even that would be so damaging and so painful for him that she didn't want him to go through it. And so the first day I was with the family, I sent the parents away and I taught the kid how to use a knife, which takes like 2 seconds. And then the second day I was with them, I had them come with me and I gave the kid a bike. He's 10 years old. He's never ridden a bike before. His mother is like shaking on the ground. She has one knee on the ground. She's like falling over. And frankly, so was the kid, because at first nobody's good riding a bike. And he kept using his right leg to make the rotation, and then he would forget the left leg. And it turns out you spiral when you do that, which I hadn't realized. But anyways, after about an hour of the kid, you know, riding slowly and falling somewhat and getting back up and doing the spiral and finally remembering to use his left leg, at the end of an hour or so, he could ride, 50 feet, let's say. It wasn't Lance Armstrong, but he could stay on a bike for a few minutes. And when the mom came home that afternoon and her own mother was there at the house, this mom burst through the door and she said, "Guess what, Mom? Sammy can ride a bike." And the grandmother, Russian grandmother, says, "What? Our Sammy can ride bike?" And she's like, "Yes, Sammy can ride a bike. Sammy can ride a bike." And they started dancing around together. And I'm looking at them thinking, these are the two women who prevented him for 10 years from sitting on the banana seat and using his feet at all on a bicycle. And they were so proud. And that's when I realized that this is going to be the answer to everything. Me telling you that the crime rate is back to the 1963, that our brains work like Google and we fantasize terror and we feel like we have no support, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't matter. What matters is seeing your kid do something, especially something that you absolutely loved as a child. And once they do it, once they go and they walk the dog, they run the errand, they ride their bike, they walk to school, and they come back, which they will, you're so proud. The pride and the joy that you feel in your heart, like it's like the Grinch. There's no space left for the terror, because the terror was artificial and the pride and joy are real.
It sounds to me like some of this is a question of whether we're more afraid of what's out there or what's in here, if you know what I mean. Like, you talk about the danger of obesity. That's not a danger that comes from out there, like a kidnapper is a danger out there. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. One is something that you can see and happens immediately and that you get blamed for, or that you fear you will be blamed for. Why wasn't she with her kid? If she was with her kid, X, Y, Z, nothing would have happened. But somehow it's almost superstitious these days. We feel like if we have our eyes on our kids all the time, nothing bad will happen to them. And if we turn our backs, literally, God will strike them dead. So, that's why you can't let your kids outside unless you're riding alongside them for all day Saturday, which you won't do. You can't let them out. So we think.
Do you let your kid ride around on a bike? Why or why not? How's it been going either way? Do you ever question your choice? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. When we come back, we'll hear whether our neighborhoods are even designed for kids on bikes. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Lenore Skenazy of Free Range Kids about a decline in bike ridership among the elementary school set. Hi again, Lenore.
Oh, hi, Gina.
You can join this conversation about whether it's safe for kids to ride bikes around Kansas City at 816-235-2888. We especially want to know whether your kids are allowed to go out on bikes alone. 816-235-2888. My next guest in the studio this morning is Aaron Bartlett. He's with us from the Mid-America Regional Council, or MARC, where he's the bicycle and training coordinator. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
How does community design play into this issue of how safe parents feel putting their kids on bikes?
Well, I think you have a number of different ways that communities have been designed over the years. If you go back to the 40s and 50s, and even the 60s, you'll find that a lot of the roads that were built in Kansas City were connected. A lot of the local streets were connected to one another. So many of these local streets have low traffic volumes, low speeds, and they're very pleasant to ride. As we started moving into the 70s and 80s, obviously, our development patterns changed. And we began to create cul-de-sacs where the local street did not go through. we began to funnel a lot of this traffic onto collectors. And those collectors then fed into arterial streets.
So collectors as opposed to through streets.
Right.
So that's not a very long bike ride.
No. And so the distances between, say, point A and point B might be the same as far as the crow flies. But now, because of the way that the roads are designed, the hierarchy of them, the distance to actually ride that distance is maybe doubled or even more. So it is a different type of design. Our communities don't look the same as they once did.
We've heard that bike ridership is down among kids. What about walking? What are the statistics on kids walking to school in Kansas City and surrounding suburbs?
Well, you know, I think Kansas City is probably no different than a lot of the other parts of the country. I mean, we've experienced the same kind of declines in kids that are walking to school or biking to school. You know, it's and I think where the bright spot is that some of the programs like Bike Walk KC has put into place, where we've been working with communities around safe routes to school. That's where we're beginning to see more children walking to school. And we are seeing the kinds of programs where you have the walking school bus, where you have some adults that are walking with the kids, acting much like a school bus would, and also bike trains. That same kind of concept, except you're on a bike now, and you're biking along with others.
So you make the shape and size of a train kind of like the idea that you're something large and foreboding on the street by the number of people who are doing this together. Is that the idea? And that there's a driver, like a parent?
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is safety in numbers. You're going to be more visible. But it's also the idea, too, that you're riding together. So you're getting a chance to be with your friends. You're getting a chance to see your neighborhood and, you know, begin to see the street trees and the grass and the flowers and a lot of the other things that you would miss on a simple, you know, trip to school inside the car. What we do know is that the perception that kids have of their trip to school is very different depending on what kind of mode they use. And if they're out on their bike or they're walking, they describe a community that is drawn very differently than one that is experienced in the backseat of a car.
That's interesting. What's the difference?
Well, the kids that draw what their neighborhood looks like on their way to school will draw things like flowers, and they will draw trees and, you know, houses. But kids that are driven to school, you know, they don't have that kind of perception of that trip. So it's more generic.
So,
for
like
a better word,
it's just maybe like a stoplight or something.
Well, they'll have a picture of once they get to school, or, you know, mom and dad and everybody's getting in the car, those kinds of things.
That's really interesting. What about this positioning of schools issue that came up in that story we heard earlier? I mean, with the consolidation of public schools, we know that any given school now serves a bigger geographic area.
Well, that's true. So some of the things I talked about earlier around the 60s and 70s as our roads were changing, at the same time, there were a lot of new pressures that are being placed on schools. And one of the things that started happening in the 1970s is schools began to be located out on the edge of communities where the land costs were lower, the acreage available was higher. And so they were looking for places that they could build larger schools, sort of economies of scale, and then have larger student enrollment. So what was happening here is actually those peripheral schools were being located on roadways that eventually would become arterials or collectors where they had more traffic. And you were finding that the distances, because those areas that they were serving were getting larger, the distances for those students to walk to school, 2, 3, 4 miles longer, or even sometimes much more, were growing. So you began to see more and more of the kids being driven to school for these larger schools.
So it does sound like there are some real design issues that would go along with rises in parental fears.
Well, you know, I think we've seen traffic danger as being one of the things that parents will indicate is a problem or one of their reasons why they don't let their child walk or bike to school. We've talked about distance to school as being one of the things that ranks up there at the top.
So you've asked parents this within our own area?
No, actually, I'm looking at a survey that was done by the Safe Routes to School National Group. And they did, it was reported in the Center for Disease Control. They looked at adults, 1,588 adults, and they asked them what were some of the barriers to walking or bicycling to school for their youngest child, aged 5 to 18. And in those cases, we saw distance to school was about 60%, traffic-related dangers around 30%, weather came in at around 18%, crime danger around 12%. And then sometimes even the school itself will have an opposing policy that says the kid cannot walk to school.
Whoa, really?
Right.
Yes. And so that's an issue, too, that we try to work with the school district to get over those kinds of issues. But the fear of liability and all these other things begin to pervade into the school district thinking as well.
So we're back to fear. Lenore Scanese, what do you know about school districts and their policies around things like this?
Well, I'll just tell you the most recent school district decision I heard, and I think it relates exactly to fear and particularly fear of lawsuits, is that in Richland, Washington, and now in Spokane, Washington as well, the school districts have decided to get rid of all the swing sets on their playgrounds because they did a survey and they realized that swings were the number one way kids get hurt on playgrounds. And of course it is. They've gotten rid of the teeter-totters. They've gotten rid of the merry-go-rounds. You know, first they came for the merry-go-rounds and I said nothing. And then they came for the teeter-totters and I said nothing. And now there's no swings left. And this is another example of this worst first thinking mixed with insurance. One is, what if somebody falls off a swing and then they get hurt and then they sue us? What will we say? So on the one hand, they're thinking of the worst case scenario. On the other hand, everybody is thinking that way now because we live in a litigious society. So I'm not surprised that some schools don't allow children under a certain age to walk home or walk to school or bike home or bike to school, because the assumption is if somebody gets hurt either on their way and if they're on their way to school and the school didn't say no, or they're at the school on the school premises, the school is and the school district are worried about being sued. And so there has to be some kind of blanket indemnity that says, look, it just because a child gets hurt transporting him or herself here to school doesn't mean that you can sue the school.
Well,
and I that would help in some places, I think.
When
you live in a litigious society, you only see the dangers in something. You don't see all the upside. You don't see, oh my God, all these kids, kids do better actually on tests when they come to school and they've had some exercise in the morning. They've gotten their yayas out, they've gotten exercise, they've seen their friends, they patted a dog. You know, it's a different kid than the one who's just spilled out of the SUV after waiting in a snaking line that finally makes it to the front door.
Well, let's hear from one of our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got Lisa in Mission. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning. Lisa from Mission, Kansas. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and I grew up in the big bad city. I learned to ride my bike in front of my house on my sidewalk, and I rode my bike throughout my childhood anywhere and everywhere, and it was a wonderful feeling of freedom. I have two little girls. They're big now, but when I moved here about 15 years ago, I found it very frustrating. There were really no sidewalks where we lived. And, oh, my God, that made me crazy. So I'd have to take the little bikes that they had, put them in the trunk, go to a park, unload them. Mm-hmm. And that's how we taught them how to ride bicycles. But then when we got back home, I didn't want them riding the bikes in the street. So I think that it looks like there's a trend to putting more and more sidewalks in the little suburbs here around Kansas. And that's a good thing. But yeah, so I certainly saw that as just not so great, and I missed it from my childhood, and my girls didn't get to have it. So.
Lisa, thanks so much for calling. And, I'm curious about this because I also learned how to ride a bike on a sidewalk. Adults, you're really not supposed to ride a bike on the sidewalk, but is that pretty standard for kids and accepted from a design standpoint, Aaron?
Well, I think when you've got really young children, learning to ride on a sidewalk is okay, but what you do need to stress to them is that there's also a lot of dangers. You have many times the driveways and those kinds of things that they have to watch out for. Also, if you're riding on a sidewalk, you might be riding against traffic. So a lot of times the types of crashes that you do see are where the person is coming from the opposite direction. So like in the case of our daughter, who's learning how to ride right now with training wheels,
How old is she?
She's 5 years old. And we've been riding with her and teaching her about the rules of the road and those kinds of things because we want to start early, and we want her to learn how to do that at an early age. And yes, we do use the trail systems and things like that. Those are great places to learn how to ride a bike. But you also have to use some of the local streets and things like that to be able to teach her, you know, what's a stop sign. You got to look left. You got to look right. Look left again. You know, the kinds of things that will help her actually be a better cyclist in the future.
Maybe a better driver.
Maybe a better driver.
Right. I have a question about this, though. How it sounds like you're giving her a lot of information about safety and preparedness for all kinds of situations that could arise. How do you do that without scaring her beyond what she should be, you know?
Well, you know, I think as the way we approach parenting is we're looking at it from the perspective of, yes, there are some real dangers out there. If she pulls up to a street and we're not with her, and she pulls out into traffic and hasn't, you know, learned to come to a stop at the stop sign or something like that, then these are, you know, legitimate dangers. And fear put in the right place, I think, is something that keeps us safe. You know, it's the kind of thing she needs to understand. She needs to be able to make decisions about. So I don't know that we're really too afraid of scaring her. I think what we're trying to do is to teach her these are things that you need to watch out for. So when you are riding, what do? Well,
Can I just say that sounds so great. I mean, parents have always had to teach children, you know, look before you cross the street, don't get into a car with strangers, you know, learn to stop at a stop sign. That's like treating them as, you know, responsible people, not as just scaring them. I mean, it's part and parcel of giving them the bike and giving them the freedom. So it doesn't strike me as anything extra scary. It strikes me as it goes hand in hand with learning how to ride a bike.
Lenore, you also, I mean, one of the chapters of your book is titled something like, listen to your kids. They don't want to be treated like babies unless they're babies, something like that. did you do some research on that? I mean, what is it? How do kids want to be treated around things that are scary?
Well, first of all, kids have always had the same desire, which is to become grown up, to become big, like the Tom Hanks movie. They want to be big. And that's why all of us remember getting on our bikes and this feeling it wasn't exercise, it was freedom, right? I mean, so teaching your kid that this is the way, you know, like this will get, just having to drive your kid somewhere and letting them ride is one thing. But if you're waiting at the car for them to finally finish riding and you're going to load the bikes back in, that's a different feeling from going off to get a Slurpee, going off to find your friend. Let's see where the ball game is going on. And so kids have that desire, and we can give it back to them. I wanted to mention one way that I've found that's very successful and very easy to get kids back outside and also for them to be responsible and pretty darn safe. And it's what I call the Free Range Kids Project, and it's in schools now. And the project is so simple. It's this. It's the principal telling the teachers who choose to do so to do this project in the class, which is, you gather the kids around and you say, kids, today when you go home, ask your parents if there's one thing that you feel like you're ready to do that for one reason or another you haven't done yet, and ask them if you can do it one time, and it's a school project. So kids go home, and parents are often open to this because it's endorsed by the school and it's a one-time deal. And so this is a chance for kids to, in fact, one of the things kids often do as their project is ride their bikes. And so when I did this project at a Menlo Park school, Menlo Park's where Facebook is, it's a beautiful, leafy, zillion-trillion-dollar suburb. And So one of the kids went home and said, I've been asking you all year long, I'm a fifth grader, can I please ride my bike to school? He asked yet again, this time in the context of the Free Range Kids Project. And the father, who was more nervous in this case than the mom, once again said no. But they talked about it. This was on a Wednesday. And they decided, well, you know what? We're not going to let you ride to school because there's so many cars and it's busy and it's crazy. But we will let you ride on Saturday to your friend's house. And I'll tell you what happened when we come back.
Okay. And there's still a little time to tell your story. If your kids are bucking the trend and riding bikes unsupervised in the city, tell us about your decision and whether you've ever regretted it. What did you tell your kids about safety? And how did you deal with the uncertainty while they were out? 816-235-2888 Central Standard will return. Good morning, everyone. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Central Standard. I went on two bike rides this weekend in the exact neighborhood where I grew up. Talk about time standing still, but those other people I saw on bikes, they looked a lot like me. None of them were kids. Bikes just aren't quite the childhood accessory they used to be. We've been discussing that trend with Lenore Skenazy of Free Range Kids and Erin Bartlett of the Mid-America Regional Council. Hi again, Lenore.
Oh, hi.
And welcome back, Erin.
Thank you.
Something I want to hear from each of you about before we jump into these calls so pretty quickly. Do you think it's in some ways a privileged point of view to say that kids are safe out there on their own when it might feel less that way in some neighborhoods than others? Or do you think that's a misconception and that people everywhere should feel a little safer than they do about this? I want to start with you, Lenore.
Oh, certainly. If you're living in a neighborhood where drive-by shootings, there's a lot of drug dealers in the park, you have to reconsider whether you can let your kids out safely. But if you're talking about most of our cities and most of our suburbs and country areas, you know, like I said, the crime is back to what it was in 1963. That's before color television. That's when the price of gas was 29 cents a gallon. And so the idea somehow this era is so unsafe and that quote-unquote times have changed, and therefore even in that same neighborhood that you went back to and rode your bike in, you know, it was safe but now it's not. Generally that's inconsistent with facts.
Yeah. And Erin, what about in terms of infrastructure? I mean, streets being in good repair and free of broken glass, the kind of thing that can puncture tires and leave kids stranded, we can't all take those things for granted either.
No, that's true. And definitely there are different conditions all over the region where some roads may not be kept up to the same standard as they are in other parts. And obviously that's going to have an impact. You can have other kinds of hazards in the roadway too, vehicles that have been abandoned or parked at the side of the road, things like that.
But those aren't new. That's the only thing I'm saying. No, there was no era when everything was perfectly paved, perfectly smooth, no glass, no abandoned cars. And to act as if somehow we could get around those, because, you know, if there's a car that's stopped in the middle of the road, you go around it. If there's glass, you try to avoid it. And somehow we could do that, but today's kids can't. That's where I just get frustrated, because we're acting as if somehow evolution took this U-turn and our children just can't handle anything that we could. Why? Why do we think that we could handle it and they couldn't?
That is so interesting. Let's talk to Julie in Overland Park. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What can you share?
Well, one of the things that my son and I have discovered, and he is almost 11, is a combination of technology and kids having some freedom on their bike or on their scooters, and that is geocaching. And I don't know if you're familiar with that.
But, geocaching. No, explain it for those who don't know.
Well, let me choose my words carefully so I don't take up the whole hour. The geocaching is a sort of technological treasure hunt. And exactly. There are kinds of, you can go to geocaching.com, which is where most of them are logged around the world. You can choose your location, and it will show you these geocaches that are hidden within, you can put in a mile range. The safe mile range for my son is within 2 miles of our location, of our home. And so he will take my smartphone. So A, he has a way of contacting help if he needs help or me. He also has a map, a compass, all built in, and he can see where the geocache is. They are sometimes little tiny things that you will find hanging from a tree or in somebody's front yard library. You find a logbook. Sometimes you can leave a little treasure and take a little treasure, but it is really just a big treasure hunt. And in our particular neighborhood, we have a little woods about a mile and a half away. We have a little park another mile and a half in another direction. And people have set these geocaches in these particular places, and he sets off with my phone, and he's got the coordinates where he needs to go, and he's got a little backpack. It's like watching the little man drive away with a, you know, on a like on an adventure. And
that's
it is
cool.
And he can then log it online, and I can go on the computer, and I can actually see when he's logged it. Sometimes he takes a little picture of himself, and you can post that online or not. You can choose. But it, and we even do that together. We'll throw the bikes in the car. And, you know, if I'm going to be at grandma's house, even with grandma for a little while, he'll grab his bike and go off and find one in her neighborhood. And,
thanks.
And it's,
yeah,
it's
thank
really
you so
fun.
Much. That sounds great. Let's get to another one of our callers, and then we'll hear what some of our guests have to say about what they're hearing. Grayson in Gladstone, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for joining us.
First of all, I love the idea of creativity and how allowing a child to really kind of explore things on their own without hovering around. I love what that can potentially produce in a child. And I have three young boys, all under four, actually. My wife is an amazing
wow.
woman.
and tired.
Yeah, she's a little tired, you know, all of the above. But the one thing I wanted to bring to the conversation, and I heard you hit on it a little bit before, was the fact that I think that if we don't let them do more of this exploring on their own and teaching them, you know, about dangers and this and that, that we're not teaching them to properly handle decision-making going forward.
Right.
And that if
right.
they can't, you know, be taught how to cross a street when they're young, you know, what happens if they have to cross a street?
Yeah.
Or what happens when they get older and they've never been taught a proper decision-making process to make, you know, good, solid decisions about their own
ooh,
safety,
ooh.
You know, when a bigger
ooh, let
decision
me,
comes
let me
up.
Jump in.
We
so
have an eager guest.
Oh, yes, because it's so interesting you say taught proper decision-making, but I think what you're getting at is that life sort of teaches you that. I mean, you can sit there and lecture them about, like, you must make decisions and eat the right food and be fair to your friends, but really when you have a game going on or you're on your bikes and you're going together someplace, that's when all the decision making really kicks in. It's like, well, should we go there? Is that safe? Do we all want to go there? Is it okay for the youngest kids? You know, they're a little slower. Should we go someplace else? All this practice in risk assessment and decision making and problem solving doesn't happen when kids are literally taught that. It happens when they're in a group that is unsupervised by an adult. I have to say, unsupervised play is really key. And they're making the decisions, and sometimes they make the wrong decisions. And we forget that most wrong decisions do not have dire consequences. We're so afraid. We keep doing that, what I was talking about at the beginning. Worst first thinking. What if they think that they should have a picnic on the railroad tracks? That's a bad idea. Most of them are not going to do that. And we have to trust our children to be as smart as us and also to be as resilient as we were. And in fact, it builds resilience to do some things wrong or to get lost and have to find your way back.
Let's hear how Janelle does this. Janelle has called us from Brookside. Hi, Janelle.
Hi. So I have four kiddos, and three of them ride bikes independently in the city, in the danger zone to many people. And I just feel like none of them have cell phones. They are able to do their own crisis management because things are always going to crop up that are questionable, foreign territory. And, you know, you have to be able to process through things in life.
I'm curious about something, Janelle. How we've heard a lot about this idea that letting kids go out unsupervised is what prepares them for a life of decision making, which we all have ahead of us. And I'm curious how you did you do anything in particular to prepare them for that before they started on the project? Or is it really purely trial and error?
I feel like a lot of it is trial and error. I mean, you've got the basics down, like when you walk, you know, look both ways before you cross the street. At an intersection, you stop. So you've got, like, basic traffic skills down. But beyond that, we're all going to encounter things, you know, like a person who's, you know, acting funny or something. I think that it's trial and error how you handle things. And 99.9% of the time, the decision you make may not be the right decision, but it's not going to lead to harm.
You know, Janelle, I want to follow up with you a little more because you're a parent who's called us and who's doing all these things that we've been talking about. And I think I'm not a parent, but I can imagine a parent feeling like, well, yeah, 99% of the time wouldn't make me feel better if my kid was the one this happened to. And not as far as like being guilty or to blame, but just the terrible, the magnitude of that loss and that possibility for a parent is huge. And so
going back to that's once again going immediately to this horrifying magnitude loss, the worst case scenario. And that's what I'm saying.
And I get that, but I'm saying that there are probably a lot of parents out there who are feeling that hearing this program. So I'd like for you to address it, and maybe for Janelle to address it first.
Great.
I think that I have friends who my behavior and what I allow my kids to do scares them because it seems reckless and uncaring. But to me, I feel like if I keep my kids at home and just teach them fear, then I'm crippling them emotionally. And I feel like my parents, although it may be inadvertent that they allowed us to do so much just because it was the culture of the time, but it allowed us so much freedom and confidence and the ability to be confident in your life and of your abilities.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. Lenore, and I know that you wanted to chime in on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't mean to be glib about anybody's fears because I actually think I'm a fearful parent as well, and now my kids started driving and I'm terrified. but there's two things that have helped me get over my own fears. One is somebody once sent a sentence to Free Range Kids that I loved a lot, which was, all the worry in the world doesn't prevent death, it prevents life. I found that profound.
Yeah, that is profound.
Yeah, and then the other is at the very top of this hour, you were one of the people who was quoted was from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I interviewed them for my book. They're the people who put the children's pictures on the milk cartons and said, have you seen me? And neglected to mention that the vast majority of those children were runaways or taken in non-custodial disputes. But so they made us feel very frightened. But in the end, they decided that they had been sort of pushing us in the wrong direction and that stranger danger and all of that is has been overblown in society. And the best way to have a safe child is to have a confident child. And the best way to have a confident child is to let those kids do some things on their own, because that's what Janelle was just talking about. I mean, and also Aaron, to have the problem-solving skills, to know how to get yourself out of a dangerous situation, to avoid those situations in the first place. You have to get a little street smarts, and you can't get street smarts on your couch.
Brian tweets us. He says, we are fortunate enough to live within cycling distance to our elementary school, rode with the kids to and from school every day this spring. But he adds, I grew up in the Northeast, frequently broke my parents' 3-block radius rule. I won't let my kids ride past the end of the block. So there might be different distances that parents are comfortable letting their kids travel, but a block is maybe a good start. Aaron, for you, are there parents out there hearing this who like the idea and want some support, maybe statistics about neighborhoods and safety or something like that? What are resources for parents in Kansas City?
Well, I would really recommend that they check out a website. It's walktoschoolkc.com. This was a website that's been built by a partnership with Bike Walk KC and the Mid-America Regional Council. And essentially what it does is it tries to put resources in the hands of parents who are interested in getting their kids out there walking and biking to school, but they just can't seem to get over that initial issue of, letting them ride off on their own or walk off on their own. So some of the good things that are coming out of that are that these are – these are ways to break through that, icebreakers. We have, you know, walking school bus programs and the bike trains I talked about earlier. And we also focus in on special events like Bike to School Day, which was May 6th this year. Or we have International Walk to School Day, which will be October 7th of this year.
So some formal events where you can dip your toe in?
Yeah. You know, what's really cool about that is that you get everybody in the school participating in a day like that. And all of a sudden, people realize that there isn't any traffic at school. And and all of a sudden, you know, well, you begin to reverse the cycle, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, well, I won't let my child walk to school because there's too much traffic, so I drive my kid to school. Well, now you become part of the traffic. If you can break through that, then all of a sudden people begin to look at what are the possibilities.
Right on, Aaron.
Well, our time is sadly up for today. There's so much more we could talk about. We'll just have to do that some other time. Lenore Scanese, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Gina.
And Aaron Bartlett, I really appreciate your stopping by.
Thank you.
Lenore is the author of Free Range Kids, and Aaron is the Bicycle and Training Coordinator for the Mid-America Regional Council. You can listen back to this conversation and share it with your friends later today. We'll have it posted at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, with the National Conference of La Raza convening in Kansas City, we'll discuss Latino identity. Being Latino can cover so many different stories, nationalities, languages, and yes, skin colors. That's tomorrow. Join that conversation. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's The Standard. Up to Date comes next, and Steve Kraske's got you covered. Don't miss it.